Well, good morning. I want to thank Gabe for putting this together, and it's always a pleasure to speak on it together with my New York City friends. Rikers Island has been the gold standard for decades in the United States for what we should be doing in jails in the United States. So you see I have the longest title slide in the APHA meeting here today. And I do work as a consultant just recently with the Correct Care Solutions, one of the large corporations that provide medical care in jails and prisons in the United States. And I'll talk more about what I'm doing with them, trying to get a methadone license in Albuquerque. And this is New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona, Mexico, and Texas. Poor New Mexico, so far from God, so close to Texas, is what we say. And the state has only 2 million people. This is Albuquerque, the only city of any real size, about 700,000. This is Las Cruces, New Mexico, by the border. Santa Fe, where the opera is, and close by is Española, with the highest, in the county with the highest overdose death rate in the United States of America, and Los Alamos, where they build nuclear weapons, and is the fourth wealthiest county in the United States. So interesting demographics in New Mexico, where you can have a wonderful life, go to the Balloon Fiesta in October, and go to the opera. But for other people, life is a struggle, with the highest poverty rate in the U.S., the highest child poverty rate in the U.S., very low per capita income. So if you believe that social determinants have something to do with what we do in public health, New Mexico is a case study. The official estimate had been 23,000 heroin injectors, but that's before the most recent epidemic of people with pain medication addictions turning to heroin. And the state has consistently had a very high overdose death rate. This is the U.S. This is the total overdose death by county, New Mexico, 2008 to 2012. So this is what the U.S. looks like, about 12 per 100,000, and New Mexico 24 per 100,000, and Rio Arriba County, where Española is, this town, is 67 per 100,000. So just a very horrible situation. Like in the rest of the U.S., most of the deaths are from prescription drugs, with a good proportion from heroin, and many are of course mixed overdoses as well. So in view of this situation, back in 97, New Mexico became the second state in the United States to have a statewide harm reduction syringe exchange program, which has continued to this day, and it's run by by the New Mexico Department of Health. People generally pick up their syringes and naloxone either at public health offices, of which there are 50 in the state, or through one of the contractors that do outreach to the, and those actually do much more syringe exchange, healthcare for the homeless and different organizations that are very skilled in doing this. And we give thousands of doses of naloxone to drug users and their family members. It can be prescribed by pharmacists in New Mexico as well. And we've been having trainings for it for many years. This is in Española a number of years ago. One of my favorite posters. Thousands of reversals have been documented, many more thousands since 2012. But the problem is, naloxone by itself is not a solution to this problem. It's become very popular, and I think it's wonderful that people talk about it in a positive way. There was a big article in the New Yorker about it, but
The problem is people keep overdosing. I mean, you talk to people who overdose. They overdose. No one overdoses once. When you see that, they overdose numerous times, and they'll keep overdosing until they die or they get on methadone or buprenorphine. That's the reality that we need to recognize. The federal government in this important, I forget what they called it, like, what was the name of that column, in New England Journal of Medicine by NIDA and NIH and CDC, recognize that medication-assisted therapies are a key part of addressing this overdose epidemic. And they cited one of the studies from Baltimore that by getting more people on methadone and buprenorphine, they decreased the number of fatal overdoses. So that's really what we have to be doing in the United States. And France had a natural experiment because they had no methadone nor buprenorphine until 1995. And then they rapidly increased mostly the buprenorphine, the gray, and look what they did to the overdose death rate. It plummeted. So this is what we have to do. And a lot of drug users are in jails. And this is the Bernalillo County Metropolitan Detention Center, which is the Albuquerque jail. Big complex, 22 miles from downtown Albuquerque. It's opened in 2003, one of the 40th largest jails. Currently has 1,860 people, but has often had well over 2,000, and a lawsuit tries to keep that under control. But there is a slow decline, like there is all over the United States, in the number of people being incarcerated, but it's a very big battleship to be turning around in a narrow space. They were having about 40,000 bookings a year. So just to remind people here who may not be familiar with these terminologies that a jail is short-term facility run by counties and cities, so there are thousands of them in the United States, often run by sheriff's departments, in fact, and most of the people in jails are awaiting trial. They've never been convicted of anything. They just didn't have the money to pay the bond, which is required, or they're, you know, few of them are being held on more serious charges, but that's very few. And then people often serve up to a year as well for misdemeanor convictions. Prisons, of course, are run by states, and the federal government has a prison system, and ICE has a, you know, the immigration control people have another prison system. And then there are separate juvenile facilities, and community supervision means probation, parole, halfway houses, electronic monitoring, and various drug court stipulations that people are under. So we're talking about a big penal system in the United States. So in 2004, the Department of Health decided to become involved in correctional health because there were so many public health issues that we were dealing with in people in jails. It was the perfect place to see them. You know, if you go out on the street trying to find drug users, you'll find, you know, 5, 10, 20 people in an evening. But if you go into the jail, they're all there. They're all reasonably sober, time on their hands, very interested in talking about their health and their, you know, these issues. So it's the perfect place to be for public health. And this clinic is still operating 11 years later. We do HIV, I still say we, even though I'm retired, HIV testing, immunizations, a lot of family planning. The Explanon contraception, long-acting reversible contraception, is very popular in that jail, and lots of women take advantage of that opportunity. But 6 months after we entered the jail, they allowed us to start a methadone program, and this had been planned for 2 years, involving everyone from the jail to the DEA. It was a big planning process, and we started the program for people who were currently enrolled in methadone in Albuquerque, and it was considered phase one. Phase one was continue people on methadone. The Department of Health contributed $200,000 to it, and we had a local community-based methadone program provide the methadone, which they brought every day as a guest dose to the people who were in the jail. and they had a staff, and each day the nurse went around to all the pods in the jail and delivered the doses. People were excluded who were going to prison, and one detail is that once you're sent to prison, you go back to the jail in Albuquerque. So you usually have a little time to actually taper people off. And I don't know if that's different from New York. It sounds like people go to the jail and they go straight up to prison. So, you know, we had a little more leeway for that. And then, like your program, we had an abstinence-only 12-step program, and somehow methadone people could not be included in that. Completely unfair. And so 8 years after this program had been running quite smoothly, actually, a new jail chief came in and said, "You're giving an opiate to opiate addicts. Well, why don't you just give alcohol to alcoholics? We're not doing that in this jail anymore." And he said he was going to shut the program down. And the response to it was so dramatic by patients and family members and public health people and addiction people and the medical community that they had to put on hold. And they agreed, thanks to the Drug Policy Alliance, to commission a study of the program, whether it worked. But the other thing is it made the New York Times. You know, it's a big deal when Albuquerque makes the New York Times for a controversy. So the University of New Mexico has a research wing, and of course the famous Dr. Bill Miller is associated with that program, and they studied it. It took about a year, and they went through the literature and they evaluated all the data they had from the jail, which was difficult because the data keeping was not great, but they showed that in fact, now mind you, this is a double negative, that people who were in the program were not as likely to be rebooked as people who were not on treatment. In other words, their numbers, our numbers at the methadone program looked very similar to the general population, and people who were opiate users and not on methadone, and similarly people with alcohol issues, were more likely to be back in jail within 365 days. And the days to rebooking was actually 40 days less on average than people who were not in treatment. So this was actually very important because generally studies have not been clear that recidivism is impacted for a complex series of reasons that I don't have time to go into. Now what they couldn't explain was that the length of incarceration of the methadone patients was longer. And they just said, "We don't really understand why this is." But mind you, we don't sentence people. You know, it had nothing to do with the methadone program. It's the judges who decide how long you're going to be in jail. So it's sort of, but this was used against us by our opponents. So the headline in the newspaper was, "Methadone patients stay longer in jail." So that was a problem. But the evaluation was so positive that this program works, that there's less recidivism, that they showed it cost money, even with the extra days, when you consider the extra days that people spend in jail, that the county government said, "No, you're not closing this program, you need to continue it." They didn't look at the behavior of people on methadone. And after 8 years at the jail, the correctional guards, the guards union testified in support of the methadone program at the county commission because they saw every day that patients on methadone just went about their life and were less problems for them than people who were drug seeking. So we thought that was very important, and so they didn't have the time or money to look at that, the actual behavior, and they didn't look at overdose deaths. Which it's too bad because that would have been very important. So the methadone program switched to another provider, and the DEA suddenly said, "You're guest dosing. You can't guest dose people. This isn't guest dosing," even though they'd been at the table when we planned the program. And CSAT, the other federal agency that oversees methadone, loved our program. They were always talked about it as a great program. But the DEA got their way, and the new contractor have to get their own methadone license and have the methadone in the jail and jump through a lot of hoops to create a methadone program basically with the same rules and regs as a community-based program. So this has increased the cost to the county of that $200,000 from the state was no longer enough money to have this program. And therefore, the medical provider, CCS, was told a year ago by the county, we want you to get your own methadone license. So that's how I came into the picture. They said, well, we have no idea how to get a methadone license. And frankly, neither do I, but I knew who to talk to. So I'm helping them jump through. But it's actually a good learning experience to see how complicated it is to get a methadone license. And this is very important because we always wanted our program to be something that could be replicated. And I'm afraid that all this time and money it's really a bad example for other jails in the country. They're going to say, you have to do all that to provide methadone. So in terms of the policy efforts around the country, I think we're going to need to look at this very seriously. And they're giving out 50 to 60 doses a day, and the program goes on. So it hasn't switched yet from the private contractor to the medical contractor. So great, but what about the 300 to 400 people every month who go to the jail addicted to opiates, mostly heroin, and go through withdrawal, who were not being treated? Those people are still getting nothing. They go through, a very painful, uncomfortable withdrawal with a so-called kick hit of, Kaopectate and Tylenol, and they all relapse when they get out and face death and reincarceration. So there had been a program originally where people on buprenorphine were continued, like in New York City, and they stopped that program without any justification. So a lot of people most people are still not getting what they need. And of course, phase two of our plan 10 years ago was, of which I seem to be the only person who remembers, that we had another phase, which was going to be to start people on methadone. And since then, of course, we have the option of buprenorphine when they come in. And there, as Josh did such a great job, there are lots of ways to do this. You can start people, you can do a taper, and then, if they decide they want to stay on or continue them on maintenance while they're incarcerated, you can start them just before they leave and refer them to a community-based program. And for a couple of years, we actually had a program where, through the health department, where we showed a film that was actually made in our jail, and educating people about their treatment options for opiate addiction. It had a section on how to use naloxone, and we wrote an individual prescription, we meaning me, wrote an individual prescription for 4 tablets of buprenorphine, and the instructions to Suboxone, and the instructions were, you see this prescription, it's waiting for you at Duran's Pharmacy, and you pick this up when you get out of jail. So 6 days a week, they could go, up until the evening and pick up their 4 tablets. They were instructed to break them in half, so they each got 4 milligrams a day, and that may have been a little bit much for people, but I didn't get too many complaints about it, actually. But and then they would go to the health department where they would continue on buprenorphine, and about half the people picked up their Suboxone. Why only half? Because a lot of them were wrong about when they were getting out of jail and they wound up going to prison. I mean, it was lots of things. People were transferred. I mean, but on the other hand, it did no harm to have a prescription that wasn't picked up. And the ones that got it, about half of them made it to the health department. So we thought that was a good model, but that's no longer happening because the health department cut our buprenorphine budget at the Bernalillo County Health Department from $60,000 to $5,000, and we just couldn't do it anymore. They couldn't do it anymore. So incarcerated populations should have the same access to appropriate evidence-based treatment that people have in the community, and that means MAT, and it should be available on a voluntary basis, of course, to people throughout the criminal justice system. And the WHO is very clear that people should also have access to needle and syringe programs, and there are at least a dozen going on around the world in prisons, and none of them have ever discontinued them. And a lot of them have been studied and have been published articles that these programs work. People are not waving needles at correctional officers. They've been successful. And I think we need to talk about that as well, because the times are changing. The biggest change for me in New Mexico has been the expansion of Medicaid. Unlike Utah, we did expand Medicaid. Even a Republican governor expanded it. And as a result, virtually all the drug addicted population that I see have insurance, many for the first time in their life, which covers both methadone and buprenorphine. So it's just amazing to be able to actually talk to people. When I worked in a methadone clinic where I could do buprenorphine, I said, well, you know, we have two options. And in the past, my first question was, how much money do you have? what kind of insurance do you have? I mean, why even tell people that buprenorphine when they have no money in their pocket? So that has been very positive. And therefore, the methadone clinics have been expanded. In the past, they were only in Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and Española. Now they're in Farmington and Gallup, New Mexico, Roswell, New Mexico, towns that Las Cruces that had never had methadone, and which has been really important. We have, just to remind you, the highest incarceration rate in the entire world, and we share even higher than other democratic countries like Russia and Iran and China. We have absolutely the highest, and this is something that must be addressed, and it's starting to be talked about, as you know, across the political spectrum, where not just President Obama, but the Koch brothers are saying we should not be incarcerating all these people for nonviolent drug offenses. So last week I was at the Harm Reduction International Conference in Kuala Lumpur, and the UN Office of Drugs and Crime, which is considered the most conservative of the big UN agencies dealing with AIDS, compared with, you know, UNAIDS and WHO, came out with a position paper that it was consistent with international law and treaties for countries to not incarcerate people for having for drug possession and for drug use that's, you know, other than dealing. And this was major step for this organization, but apparently a certain country between Canada and Mexico vetoed that decision. So fortunately someone leaked it, so it was handed out, and it made the New York Times, this fact that this funny leak seems, this funny disagreement. And of course, UNODC wouldn't say that the U.S. vetoed it. They said, oh, there's some misunderstanding. But find it online. It's an excellent position paper, right? Bobby's nodding his head. And, you know, it makes it clear that there are different ways of doing it. You can change the law. You could just not enforce the law. But it's in the interest of HIV prevention, hepatitis C prevention, human rights, to not be incarcerating people in the way that many countries, not just the U.S., have been doing this for decades. So it's not sustainable, and the racial disparities are now visible to everyone. And the question I present to the audience and the panel is this the time for us to try to raise the issue of MAT, correct treatment for incarcerated populations, as a part of this apparent change in political climate around addiction and incarceration and the war on drugs. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Trick. Do we have any questions? Bobby?
Just to follow up on Bruce's question to all the panelists, what would be the research designed to show that criminalization of drugs is bad? And how would we use this? And that's the question. We've heard lots of cases about why the treatment modalities are available or effective. How can we use, what is the scientific program? What are the experiments that have to be done? This is independent of the political to demonstrate to this organization, for example, that the incarceration is the wrong, you know, that it's harmful to humans and it's particularly the wrong approach to the drug addiction.
I just appreciated that this work happened in New Mexico, and to Homer's point, that if we could get some sort of picture of the country as a whole, and to explain that MAT is really a part of treatment for every community, everywhere, I think it would be very helpful, instead of these sort of exceptional places in New York or Washington or places that have the more robust public health systems and urban settings. It would be helpful.
You know, the other thing is, this is not a research, this is more of a policy implication, but I've been thinking of Hep C as the use case for getting Medicaid waivers to reimburse for care inside jail, and that certainly could be a common one. But here, looking at this issue of MAP, that's another example where we already have more than enough data to understand the mortality implication of post-release overdose. And so that also might be a good use case to go to CMS and say, look, for care that's established before incarceration, you should reimburse for that care, for that aspect of the care, components of that care while the person is incarcerated, as a way to reduce costs and also reduce mortality afterwards. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, we're sort of talking about two different things. Bobby's, I mean, it's my fault for raising the issue of decriminalization. The point is, these people shouldn't be in jail in the first place. I mean, that's the, you know, and of course the models for that are other countries, other Western countries, which have you know, approaches that do not emphasize incarceration. Of course, Portugal being the best, but I think other countries are moving in that direction. In fact, in New Mexico, there's a program called the LEAD program in Santa Fe, where if someone is arrested, cops don't have to arrest people, and what they do if they meet certain criteria of certain number of previous arrests and, you know, the level of the crime they're arrested for, usually burglary, they're taken directly to a case manager who sits down and tries to figure out how to get them housing and a job and drug treatment, and about 10% of the people in that program are on buprenorphine, and they couldn't tell me how many were on methadone, but you know, probably 90% of them should be on methadone or buprenorphine. But and I say that because the police chief of Santa Fe said 100% of their burglaries had been committed by people with heroin addiction. So that's why I know how many should be on methadone and buprenorphine. But there are models around the world, and that's not a research. That's a purely political question. But the other thing, I mean, I guess the way I was trying to connect it is that if people are starting to say maybe we shouldn't be arresting all these people and imprisoning them, it's sort of an easier argument that, well, yes, and maybe we should also be treating their addiction while they are incarcerated, or making that part of their, you know, alternative. So, I mean, that, in that sense, these issues are closely aligned.
Are the MAP issues different in prisons versus jail? You mentioned
think the question was, is MAT, the approach to MAT different in prisons rather than jails, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tougher cell. I mean, in prison, the length of stay is, what, 2.5 years. In the U.S., you know, unlike Western Europe, there's lots of acknowledgement that there's any illicit use, although there is, in the prison system. But for the most part, people will spend that 2.5 years abstinent, or relatively abstinent. So the day-to-day kind of security, psychosocial control, how happy are prisoners, there's less urgency to have them. Of course, when they leave, they have the exact same crummy relapse and death
outcome. Do prisoners often get good control on release?
There are this or that pilot programs. I wouldn't say it's standard of care. The company is heavily marketing to prisons to kill. They want to give you that first shot if you're the sheriff or the prison system, and in hopes of the prison being in the community share when they get out. So there are different headlines and little pilot projects we've been reading about. Prison systems and also from city county jail systems. But it's the jails that have this huge churn. It's less people per night in a jail, but it's more people overall per year coursing through the jail systems. It's where we have the most kind of turnover, but also probably exposure to your kind of street level heroin user in terms of volume. It's destructive in that even the short stays are detoxing people, and then they're right back out there. So, I mean, in terms of like interfacing with your local community and your local treatment systems, jails have more relevance because that's what most people experience when they're coming back from.
I have this question. If you look at the proportion of all opiate deaths, and the proportion of people that have opiate overdose deaths, and at least one night in prison or jail in the last year before they have death, what was the proportion?
It's a risk factor for overdose, as is getting out of the detox or rehab or a hospital. So any kind of controlled setting where you probably weren't on opiates is a risk factor for fatal overdose. I don't know
the... Yeah, I don't know that, and that's a good point. It's always looked at the other way. I mean, it's very good data that the people who do come out are much more likely to die, but...
Well,
here's
the other thing. I've been the best
using
public health commissioner in our state, the governor's focus on the whole opiate crisis, and not enough attention, in my mind, is focused on what needs to happen in jails and prisons around treatment, but the focus is on all the deaths. Show that, you know, a lot of the people who are dying, there is a jail-prison connection. I'm hoping that will create more energy to want to focus on jails and prisons, treatment improvement, and not just, you know, every place, fuck those, fuck that. That's my sort of policy angle.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what he said.
Put more of a comment.
Laura, comment. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm hearing a challenge. There's not a prison in the United States, to my knowledge, that has methadone. There has been a sort of a pilot in Puerto Rico going on for a number of years that's been well studied and published good results. But it's maddening. Human Rights Watch did a big report on the situation in New York State prisons, and it had a big press conference, and the New York Times had an editorial saying, yes, there should, you know, this should go through. And the last time I spoke to someone in New York who knew it, they said, oh, no, there's no method of New York prisons. I mean, they've been extremely resistant everywhere to any kind of outreach.
There should not be kind of you've seen state to state, you know, in Maine, you can only get 6 months before you stop paying for it through the Medicaid program. So you see these kind of anti-chronic therapy, chronic maintenance policies. They're not in the space, but that is back to kind of the stigma and hostility.
I mean, we sometimes call it a medical model of you know, that addiction is a chronic brain disease, and we know that the relapse rate is about 80% within a year of stopping methadone. So, but what's the relapse, what's the likelihood of my cholesterol going up if I stop my statin? Or people with high blood pressure, or people with diabetes, I mean, they stay in those meds as long as they need them, and for many people that's indefinitely. So it's important that people understand that about methadone and buprenorphine, because somehow it seems to add to the stigma. You know, oh, you have to stay on this. Well, what pill are you on? You know, are you going to stop your pill? You know, I mean, it's a special and very difficult stigma to address the problems around methadone, and that's why trying to convince 3,000 sheriffs in the United States to provide it to their people and who they're responsible for is a huge challenge.
What would you target, the sheriffs or the providers that don't give more than like Joe Edwards, but they won't get the training for it? They say they will, but they don't. So people come in at the box and then the providers would call them. You know, I mean, like, we've become
sort of
sheriffs or
providers,
medical providers.
Seems
like
there's. Yeah, no, it's a good point. You know, community standards.
We've got to stop. I'd like to thank Drs. Lee, Venters, and Trigg, and also International Human Rights for sponsoring the panel. Thank you.